This is Whitley Strieber, and this is Dreamland at the end of the year. We're wishing you a Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year with this terrific Dreamland special event. Get set for something really extraordinary. The special will run over the next 2 weeks, and then we begin again. The new year will be upon us. What adventures await? Well, first, I'd like to wish everyone a wonderful Merry Christmas. And a Happy New Year, because this is a double show this 2 weeks. First hour, we're going to be talking to one of the greats, Jim Semivan. Second hour, we're going to be talking to Leslie Kane, another of the greats, and both of them are dear friends of mine. When I go to New York, I always stay with Leslie in her apartment. And I never spent any time with Jim and his wife in their house. And it'd be
always
interesting
welcome.
If we do. That's right. Okay, let's talk a little bit first about Jim. Jim spent 25 years as an operations officer for the Central Intelligence Agency, now working in sensitive overseas assignments. I don't know if he wants to talk about those, but suffice to say they were indeed sensitive, some of them. After he retired, he became one of the founding members of the Two of the Stars Academy, where he worked alongside such people as Hal Pudoff, who I've been trying to get to interview on my show for years, and I'm going to try to nail him down again. We're having breakfast together in a few weeks, and I'm going to try to see if I can get him to. I've tried many times, though, folks, and he always wiggles out of it. Jim has described he had some extraordinary experiences with his wife, and he's described them as not metaphoric but physical. Now, we're going to talk not only about disclosure and intelligence agencies and all of that stuff, but also we're going to go deep into Jim's contact experience, because I listened to Jim on the TV and on other podcasts, and they pass right over the important stuff because they're not experiencers. Mm-hmm. But this is an experiencer show. I'm an experiencer, and so is Jim. So, Jim, welcome to Dreamland.
Well, thank you so much, and thanks for having me, Whitley. I've enjoyed your work since Communion. I've been reading you, matter of fact, I was just going over some notes I had from The Fourth Mind and from them about a week or two ago in preparation for a podcast I had done. And I consider you one of the best analysts out there regarding the UAP and the phenomenon.
Well, tell that to the Soul Foundation. They need to let me speak there at some point soon.
I think that they have their focus, you know, and I think their focus is more on the nuts and bolts end. So.
But the nuts and bolts end is an appendage. They're focusing on that because it's hard to focus on the experience end of it, because there are a lot of issues. And I want to start with this. We have talked about the issues surrounding disclosure, and I believe there are two possible types of disclosure. One is limited disclosure, which is all anyone can do now. The president on down, all they can really do is say, non-human intelligence is here. I think that leads in some very dangerous directions for society. And I thought I'd like you to comment on disclosure in general and why it seems, at least to me, so unlikely that that's going to happen.
Well,
or maybe it doesn't seem that way to you. I don't know.
Well, actually, it does. I mean, I think we're in agreement. I think you mentioned in the Fourth Mind, you talked a lot about this, the idea that, you know, it might not be a completely good idea to have disclosure, at least the way most people would like to see disclosure happen. One of the issues I have is I'm all for disclosure, and I think you are too. I'm hoping that you know we'll get something at least in our lifetime that will let us know that yes, indeed, the government is aware of this, as with other governments are aware of this. But there are so many problems associated with disclosure, even limited disclosure. And I've discussed this with numerous people, you know, friends of ours, and about how this would happen. I've spoken with government people in government, different government agencies about this, and how something like this could happen, and what they would need to do. I think Carl Nell, I don't know if you're familiar with Colonel Carl Nell, he wrote
I know Carl.
He did a wonderful presentation on limited disclosure and the difference between limited and catastrophic disclosure. And I thought that was a really good basis for any kind of a government willing to take that next step. That said, you know, I can't imagine the U.S. government hasn't thought about this over the last 80 years and hasn't in some way figured out if they were going to do this, how they would do it. But I think they haven't surmounted some hurdles, and I think probably the biggest one for them isn't really national security. It probably would be ontological security, and yes. By that I mean the classic, you know, Gibbons. He wrote a book in 1984, Anthony Gibbons, on ontological security and what it means for people in general. Being able to be shaken out of your reality. We're not really sure how people would be affected by that. We have a lot of people say, yeah, we can handle it, but I'm not so sure that's the case, particularly if
I'm not sure at all.
Well, you know, and Willie, you know this better than anybody. This is what I love about you, because you focus on this. You focus on the other, and you do your absolute best to try to find out what it is we're actually thinking about. And this is one of the things you discussed in the Fourth Mind, which I really loved. And it's this whole idea is we don't even know what the heck it is. And if we don't know what it is, why would we walk into it? You know, as an intelligence officer, if I was working on an operation, a clandestine operation, or a covert action operation, which all of it was overseas. It's illegal for the CIA to do this in the United States, by the way, but it was all overseas. And when you would do that, you would always look at what's the chance of success. And if you didn't have at least an 80 to 85% chance of success, you generally wouldn't do it, because it's too dangerous for all kinds of reasons. So you might have too many points of failure. You might have too many working parts, so to speak. So you'd be very, very careful about that. Well, in this particular case, particularly with disclosure, there are so many working parts. There are so many dots that you would have to basically explain and develop some type of explanation for. You'd have to have a narrative that you'd be able to continue on this topic. So the president just can't come out and say we have a downcraft and NHI do exist, and I can't tell you anymore because most of it's classified. Can you imagine being in the room when he said that? Can you imagine people saying, well, wait a minute, I got a million questions, and the president saying, I'm sorry, I can't answer them for you. Well, you can't do that, because if you do that, everybody who's involved in this, and there are a lot of bad players involved in this, I think the bad players will eventually drowning out the good ones. And I think you're going to have sort of people in there with an axe to grind trying to fill in the narrative. And that's what becomes dangerous. So if the government ever came up with a narrative and thought through this and was able to engage the public almost daily on this, and then engage religious institutions, the political institutions, and prep them, and then say, okay, here's the narrative, here's what we're going to say, here's what we're going to stick to, and then have a way for people to discuss this, because it would be just so dramatic. And I don't think they have that yet, and I don't think they know how to explain it. And all they have to do is read your books, Whitley, because they know how complicated it is.
Well, my books are intended. I have to admit, I didn't know this when I started writing them, but I have understood over the years that they are intended to cushion the shock of the new, the ontological shock.
Yeah.
But it's not just the ontological shock is not just the shock of the new. It's an overturning of everything you understand about reality. And that is exactly what happens when you come close to these people, to the Greys or any of them. I've been close to the Greys for years, and there are others out there. I met one of the Nordics years ago in a rather interesting context that made it me certain that he was what he said he was. I've met three of the tall whites, two of two adults and a child. And this is all, and there are more here aside from those. And we don't have any idea, I don't think, where any of them are from. I've had enough contact with people in the areas of the government. I'm not going to go into too much detail because I can't, not because I'm constrained, because I'm not sure of my ground, but I don't think we know where they come from. I do think that there is an element of the physical here that connects to the non-physical in ways that don't make sense to us, basically. And there's so much that we don't understand. And how can the president of the United States or any world leader go out and say, well, they are here and we don't know what the hell they're doing, except they're doing it to you. Thank you and good night. That's just not going to happen.
No, it isn't. It isn't. And I think you're so right on this. And it's not just you and I did agree with it. I think a lot of people, I know Hal to a certain degree, believes in disclosure, but he's also reluctant. He has some, a lot of concerns about this. I remember reading a quote by Max Planck. I remember one of the founders or initially one of the founders of quantum mechanics. And he said, if this doesn't scare the hell out of you, and he was talking about quantum mechanics, he said, then you don't understand it, or you're not reading it the right way, because it should scare you. I mean, essentially what they're saying is we're all just basically energy patterns, right? And if that's the case, if you look at an atom, close enough, you're not going to see anything. You might see vibration. Well, what does that actually mean for us? It means that we're really, I guess you can call us spiritual beings in a sense, with these corporeal bodies. If you dig deep enough, we're just basically balls of energy. So I think there is so much that would need to be explained to people, and particularly if they start reading up on this and they get into the abduction scenarios and they realize, holy cow, this has happened, and it could happen to us. As one prominent ufologist once told me, he said, are you ready to scare a 7-year-old by talking about this? And it sounds, at first it sounds like, well, that's not what we're looking for, but it's true. I mean, you affect everybody from the youngest child to the oldest person when you talk about this. Everybody then starts questioning where they fit in their quote unquote home with a capital H. Do they have sovereignty? Do they have free will? Where are they in the nature of things, in the structure of things? And then they begin to realize, well, gee, if I'm not seeing everything because of my sensory package is so primitive, what does that actually mean? Am I living in an era? I mean, I'm living in a space that doesn't allow me to see the truth, reality, the truth, with a capital R. That is not an easy thing to digest.
Well, you know, getting back to quantum mechanics tells us that reality makes no sense whatsoever, but it's still here.
Yeah.
And, you know, it still works. So there's something we're missing there. And
well, they haven't really figured out how to put the micro and the macro together. Missing thing in quantum between, you know, the current theory, the, you know, we have the Einstein's theories and then the quantum theories. There doesn't seem to be any kind of a bridge that we can identify how that quantum world sort of meshes up with the macro world in a way that's understandable. Right. I think we're sort of stuck there. Yeah.
Well, why it looks like this when it's actually so completely indeterminate is the fascinating question. And what is the observer effect? Because we see it all the time, folks, in quantum physics. There's a simple experiment that requires an observer to make anything come from a vague kind of field into something specific. But where is this observer? Because the whole universe is not in a quantum state. Or is it only not in a quantum state when we're looking at it? We don't know. So,
we
don't know. So let's go on now a little bit down the road into your experience and your wife's experience. There's another thing I want to unpack a little bit before we go there. And that is, there is someone out there who is doing pretty well with in the public space, who you know and is a close friend of yours, and I know, and he's not a close friend, but certainly an acquaintance of mine. I have very positive thoughts about him. Is Chris Bledsoe? Chris is doing well with this. He has his lady, and he's moving right along, and I don't think he is. Well, let's talk. I know you know Chris very well, and we're not going to be talking behind Chris's back here. That's not
on
my show. But I wish he would come on my show, but so far that hasn't happened. A lot of people are scared of me, but you're not. So tell me about your experience with Chris and his whole gestalt is that he's doing this, and he's just an ordinary guy, just like us, or most
people. Yeah, that's what I was brought together with Chris through a third party, a fellow named Larry Fraschella out of Pennsylvania, who was friends with Chris before I was, and he introduced us because he thought that Chris would benefit from meeting with me and my wife and then hearing our story. And then we met in New York City, and we met in a conference room at a very nice hotel there. And Chris was there with Yvonne, his wife, and then I think Emily was there, his daughter, and perhaps another one of their kids. I can't remember for sure. And my wife and I, and we basically explained, you know, what had happened. We told them our story, and I knew of Chris's story. There was a lot of emotion in the meeting. A lot of tears were shed on both sides because, you know, we sort of met in the middle. And although Chris's story was by far more dramatic than mine and my wife's, but when I got to know him even better and went to visit him at his house, and we've had, you know, many, many hours of conversation, it became very, very clear to me that this is a very nice, nice man, a very honest man, a clean living guy, with a great family, and they were obviously great parents, both of them, because their kids are wonderful. And when you saw everything that he was going through, and when he explained, you know, the absolute terror of this first, you know, meeting he had with these incredible beings, and then later on what happened to him. And then later on, he got to the point where he actually evolved, where he picked up, you know, some healing capabilities, some psychic abilities. He felt much, much better about the situation. Where he speaks to it now is a very, very transformative, you know, experience. Most like an initiation, you know, where he's initiated into these sacred arts, and he's come through it rather well. So now he spends a lot of his time with a lot of people. I mean, and God bless him. You know, we don't agree on everything. He has a very, very positive view of I think the other, and I don't share that completely with him. But that's pretty much all we have that's not in common. But everything else we do. But I consider him and his experience and the experience his family's had, you know, to be probably one of the most genuine of this particular movement. It's just an incredible story.
Well, it is. And he's got lots of video of orbs and so forth, yeah. And you've been there when they've showed up, as I believe.
Yeah, I have. I remember before I went down to see him, he sent me a picture of an orb that he had taken. And it was green, of all things. I still have it. And he said, "What do you think?" And I looked at it. I could not believe it. It was the face of what you, Whitley, would probably describe as a kobold. Is that correct? One of those little
the little ones, yeah, with the frog-like faces.
Yeah, and it looked. I mean, it was clearly that face in there. It was green. It was totally green in that orb. And you could see the shimmering light. Clearly, it was some kind of a plasma effect that was going on in there. And then he sent me one that looked like the picture inside looked like a jack in a playing card. You know, the jack of hearts or the jack of spades or something like that. And then he sent me one that looked, and he said, it looks like my dog who passed away, a picture of my dog in there. And you could clearly see it. And so his dealing, the orbs are amazing. And he and his wife visited us a couple of years back, and we were out, you know, in the middle of the night looking up the sky at orbs, and we're trying to find orbs, and saw a lot of Leo sats, and then we saw Starlink, Elon Musk Starlink, which is absolutely beautiful. If you've never seen it, it's well worth going out there when it passes over. It's just an amazing piece of work. But then eventually we did see them. Normally they would get close to him. This time they did not, probably because I was there and there was a couple other people there. So, but they clearly stopped, a little bit of a zigzag patterns going on. And so it was a thrill for me to be able to see those. Although I don't like the hitchhiker effect. I don't want to deal with that anymore. So,
well, yeah, you're like me. I've had a very complex experience. It's not, yeah. You know, Chris's experience is beautiful, and I think to myself sometimes, is it that the Catholics get the hard stuff and the Pentecostals get the good stuff? And what are we missing here? Because you and I are both Catholics. Hal Pudoff's a Catholic, and Hal's had plenty of rough stuff in his life. I know he doesn't like to talk about it, and I'm not going to talk about it either for that reason. But what about religion? And, you know, Catholic, I'm not as active a Catholic as you are, or how?
I'm not an active Catholic at all. I left the church early. Yeah, when I was.
Yeah, well, okay. Well, you are like me, a Catholic,
recovering.
Whether you know it or not. But the Pudoffs are very active in the church. They're very Catholic.
Yes.
And there are quite a few other Catholics in this field in general. especially when you get to the area of the official world or close to the official world. A lot of the ones who have had experiences are also Catholics. And one case, the man I can't mention by name, but we both know him, and you could probably guess who he is, folks, who became a Catholic. Or Diana Pasulka is another one. She's a strong Catholic and very involved.
Yeah.
What is this about?
Yeah. I'm not really sure. I have a deep respect for the Catholic faith and the Catholic Church in general. My older brother and my, a lot of my friends, Catholics, very devout. I'm not. But I think there's a strong mystical theme, I mean, that runs through the Catholic faith. And I mean, it clearly, it all goes around this whole idea of redemption, the idea of resurrection, the idea of in the Mass, transubstantiation. I mean, very, very mystical. And I think people that are open to that maybe have more of a tendency to be open to other things, too. Now, most Catholics, the run-of-the-mill Catholics, I call them, who go to church, and Sunday or maybe twice a year, they don't really focus too heavily on that. They may pray, they may go to confession. But when you actually look at the rituals involved with the Catholic religion, they're very mystical. And, just going to confession and sitting with the priest and then explaining to the priest, what are your, what your sins were. And then the priest saying to you, in the name of God, I am God's representative on earth, and I am going to now absolve you of these transgressions. And I'm going to do it, and it's going to be real because I remember walking out of confession the first time, going, "Wow, I feel cleaner, right? I feel like I'm a different person." So I think if you lived your life as a Catholic every day, and you were meaningful, like my older brother, sadly he passed a while back, but I mean he would go the Mass every day and very, very much involved with that, and particularly with the mystical experience of being a Catholic.
I also think that the Catholic Church preaches relationship with saints, with the dead. And the experience is very connected to relationship with the dead. So there's a kind of a natural comfort level for Catholics in this experience, because there is something connected between the living and the dead and non-human intelligence. It's almost as if whoever they are, they don't live with a veil between the living and the dead. Their world, in their world, it's all one thing. That's the best I can do. But I want to now go into a little bit, if you could, about your experience itself, what happened to you. And he basically, folks, he's told this so many times, and I'm sure you've heard it, so I'm going to go over the initial part myself very quickly. He woke up, and there were three entities standing at the foot of the bed. Can you take it from there?
Yes. They were, mind you, I had been a student of esoterica and the occult for many, many years, probably since I was in college. So, but I never had any kind of relationship with UAP and the phenomenon in general. I was mostly concerned with mysticism, particularly when I was in grad school. I liked Emanuel Swedenborg. I read most of his works, Ralph Waldo Emerson's, who was a big fan of Swedenborg, by the way. And so I liked that. I was a big fan of the Transcendental movement in the U.S. and then and the British Romanticism, and then earlier than that, German Romanticism. So I sort of had a grounding in a lot of that. So I've been in there very, very much about UFOs, except sort of on the periphery. So I went to bed one night, my wife and I, and we don't have any children, and we lived in we lived in a house. It was built in the 50s, but it was a nice spread out sort of two level on a half of an acre on an old Civil War encampment. And before that Civil War encampment, it was an Indian campground. And we went to bed normally do, and it was either Thursday or Friday, you know, night. No, it was a Thursday night or a Wednesday night. I can't remember exactly what. And I woke up. I was laying on my back because I had a little hiatal hernia, so I had a little wedge pillow. So I'm laying on my back, and I went right to sleep like I always do. And the next thing you know, I open up my eyes, and there are these three beings at the foot of my bed. And I wasn't the least bit afraid. As a matter of fact, I was a little bewildered, and bewildered only in the sense that I didn't have a lot of movement, but I did have movement, and they had these little, I don't know, like a smile, but it wasn't really a smile, because they had these real thin line for lips, and they didn't look like grays. They looked like very angular faces, grayish brown, sort of greenish eyes, almond shaped, very, very tiny little triangle thing for a nose. I didn't notice any ears. It could have been slits there. But their mouth, I'll never forget, their mouth was sort of upturned just a little bit, like they were smiling at me. And, but they had, it was interesting, and they had black body armor on their heads and from their neck all the way down. And by that, and they were later explained to me called Bibendi, the plural for Bibendum, who was the Michelin tire man. That's how they described them, and people described them. And they, Colm Kelleher once, he's the one who sort of told me what he thought they were. The hats were sort of like a triangle, and but just black, round body armor on the head, and from the neck all the way down on the arms. And I remember,
sounds like they didn't trust you very much.
You know, and I, you know, what I remember was me remembering that this is not a dream, and this is not a hypnagogic state. I was wide awake. And, but again, I wasn't afraid. But I remember looking over to see how my wife was, and you've met my wife, Debbie.
Yes,
and
I have.
And there she was, you know, sort of curled up in a fetal position in the bed, covers not on her, which was unusual. And I looked up, and they were there. And then all of a sudden that ended. And then there was another, I didn't know how to say it, is like the next thing you know, Debbie and I and this entity, something very tall behind me, but I couldn't see its face, but it was tall. And I always had this feeling that he had his arm around both of us, but I'm not sure about that. But it, again, very real. But it was in black and white. The first part was in color, right? And Jacques Vallée explained to me this is not unusual because it has a cinematic effect sometimes to these kind of experiences. And the being was asking us or telling us, look up into the sky. And we were behind our house in a wooded area on a road, which is the road behind our house, Sharon Chapel Drive. Oh, that's what it was. And we were standing there and looking up, and there were these three orbs, two at the bottom, one at the top, in a triangular formation. And they're shimmering, and they're big. And I remember looking at them, and I remember looking at my wife, down at my wife, and saying, and please excuse my French, and I said, let's get the fuck out of here before they come back. I said that directly to her. And when I said that, I looked back up, and these three orbs merged into one and shot up through the sky. And then the third part of this was, because it was divided up into three parts, was me watching, again in black and white, my wife and I running to get back into the house, right? And then after that, my eyes opened up. It was exactly 7 o'clock in the morning. I was, what the hell is that? You know, I mean, I the thing what shook me more than anything else was I knew what a lucid dream was. My wife's a clinical psychologist. We've talked about these things before, and so I knew what they were, and I had lucid dreams before, but this was nowhere near this. I got up, I was so animated, and for me, at 7 o'clock in the morning, I'm not animated. And I mean, I dragged myself. I was just beside myself. I didn't know what to think. And I got up, and I couldn't find Debbie, and then all of a sudden, I see the bathroom door ahead, and it was closed. So I got up and knocked on the door, and she opened it up, and I said, you don't believe what just happened. And she said, oh, please. She said, I'm not feeling really well. And I said, are you all right? And she was throwing water on her face and said, no, I am not. She said, something's really off. She said, I'm bleeding and I don't know what's going on. And she said, you know, never happened to me before and I'm really don't feel well. So I said, okay, great. Let's get you to a doctor. And so she called her doctor. We got her down there. And anyway, long story short, she was bleeding for what, 17 straight days, and they could not figure out what had happened.
Bleeding where?
Where women bleed. You know.
Oh, I see. Okay, yeah. I understand.
And I didn't want to say vagina on your show, but I guess that's okay. So anyway,
okay. We've done it. We've been there and done that now.
Been there and done that. Okay. So, again, we're not putting two and two together, but while we were getting our clothes on to go to the doctor, she looked at me and she said something like, what's on the back of your neck? And I said, what? And she said, it's all bloody. You have a hole back there. And we didn't focus on it too much. So we got her, you know, got her, took her to the doctor, brought her back home. And then I went into work and I always wore, you know, the same, you know, uniform to work, which, because I used to meet with a lot of the private sector people and other government agencies. So I always had to wear a suit and I was in a blue shirt or a white shirt, starched, heavily starched. And I went in there at the work, and I remember my neck feeling funny, and I thought it was just a starchy collar. But I ran into a buddy of mine who was working in my I was a chief of a branch at the time, in a what we would call a field office or a station in the D.C. Washington D.C. area, and I was sending everybody home because I said, it's luck Friday. This is go home. And the young fellow that was there, I knew he had a doctorate. I knew he had written a couple of books. I didn't know his real name. He was a deep cover officer. And I asked him where he was going. And he said he was going to Virginia Beach to a UFO conference at the Edgar Cayce Institute. And I said, oh, can I tell you something what happened to me the other night? And he goes, yeah. And I told him the story I told you. And then he's asking me if there's any kind of unusual marks on my body. And I said, did it ever happen before? No unusual marks on my body. Any scoop marks, nothing like that. Then he said, what about your neck? What about your head? And when he did I went like this, you know, sort of. And I went, yeah, my neck hurts. And my wife said I have something back there, a pimple or something. And so he got out of his chair. He undid my tie and pulled my neck back, my collar back, and he says, your collar's all bloody. And he said, you have a hole in the back of your neck that's beginning to scab over, and it is the exact circumference of a pencil eraser. And I said, really? And he said, yeah. And he gets up. He goes back to his seat, sits down, and he said, you want me to tell you what I think happened? And I said, yeah. And he said, I think you had an abduction experience. And I said, well, I wasn't familiar with that term. And I don't call it that because I call it an experience because I don't know in the end what it really was. But nevertheless, it had all the elements of it. And, he asked me, he started telling me about it, explaining it to me. But then he had said something very, very odd, out of the blue. He said, did your wife have any unexplained bleeding? Just like that. That's when it hit me. because, you know, I don't mind you. I'm from Youngstown, Ohio, you know, grew up, you know, semi-rough, but, you know, I don't mind getting pushed around a little bit, you know, what have you, manhandled, you know, but don't touch my wife, you know. I mean, I got really angry when I thought, okay, something came into my room. Something did something to me and my wife. I'm okay. She isn't, not good. And ever since that time, I still consider it a human rights violation, and which makes me incredibly wary of this phenomenon or whatever the hell it was. And then it was about and there's a lot more to this, but we had we were going to a formal event, I don't know, maybe a year later, and we were late, and Debbie was in the bathroom, and I said, "Deb, we have to get going." And she said, "Well, something's in my face." And I said, "What are you talking about?" And she's hacking, right? It's really rather indelicate, and it was indelicate watching her hack. And she said, "Something's in my face." And she's holding her nose, and she has these Kleenex in her hand. And finally, she hacks up through her nose, came out a little tiny piece of metal, perfectly square. For those of you old enough to know what a sensen is, it is about that size, maybe a little bit smaller than a sensen. Anyway, we didn't know what the hell that was. We saved it. And I, you know, over the years, I used to show it to friends of ours who were doctors or nurses, and they had no clue. But it wasn't until John Alexander and I met in 2014 that he heard our story, and he took it to Hal's lab, where he and Eric Davis looked at it much, much closer. And of course it came out, you know, we don't know. It's inconclusive. We don't know what it is. There's no marks on it or anything like that. Could be anything. But we couldn't find a commercial application for it. So we don't know what that was about. And that sort of, in 2014, that sort of started the whole process with me. But interestingly, when that happened, and I'll just end it after this, I was visited when John heard my story and he told Hal and Eric. Then I got contacted by some people. And first, Jacques Vallée came out to my house, which was very wonderful. He's such a wonderful man. And we spent the day together, all three of us. And he was very, very helpful. And then some people came to my house had a little mobile lab with them, and they took my blood and my DNA and my wife's blood and DNA. They asked for our medical records, and I have been keeping our medical records since 1983, the year we got married, my wife and I. So I had a big stack of medical records for my wife and myself. So I handed them to him, just handed it to him. And he was a doctor. You know him, obviously, Whitley. And
yes, I know him well. And yes. Go ahead. But folks, we can't say his name. And not because it's necessarily, wait a minute. Not necessarily because it's classified, but he doesn't like it said, and he has a hell of a temper. That's why we can't say it. So go ahead.
And I respect him, you know.
Me too. I respect him greatly.
Right. And so he took the medical files, and then, it was like a week or two later, my wife and I were just coming back from Toronto on a short trip, and we were at National Airport getting in our car, and I get a call from this guy, the doctor, and he goes, and he wasn't happy. He was sort of, I don't know why I say pissed off, but he goes, why didn't you, because he was very concerned about my neck, and they were trying to figure out, you know, and what that could mean, and, you know, there's no apparent scar there. But apparently he had found in my medical files an x-ray that was taken, a full frontal x-ray that was taken of my head and my mouth and my neck, because I had TMJ really bad. And they thought, you know, they were trying to get the proper treatment. My dentist, and they did a full frontal on me, x-ray, but the frontal was in there, and it was probably from a year after, or 2 years after our incident, or maybe it was like a year. I'm not quite sure because I didn't write anything down back in the times, but it clearly showed what the doctor said was a puncture biopsy. And he said, why didn't you tell me you had a puncture biopsy? And I said, I never had a puncture biopsy. He said, it's very clear that's what this is. He said, he said, I'm not the only one who's saying this. He said, there were a couple other doctors involved. And he said, we put some, you know, computer-assisted software on here. We were able to look at it. Somebody went in and took tissue, and you can see it very clearly. The little mark with the tissue was gone. So he immediately sent me to a hospital to get another X-ray to see if it had healed, and it had. And there was no evidence of anything. It was just healed completely. So at that point, I became even more convinced that, you know, yeah, I mean, I have the physical evidence here. I've something clearly is going on. And then the more I read about, you know, by this time I had read a lot of stuff. I read all your works up to that date. So I had a pretty good background in what we call abduction and scenarios. So that was that. But was interestingly is after that, we had always had poltergeist activity in our house. We lived in an old house built in 1954, like I said, on this old Civil War encampment and former Indian campgrounds. I'm sorry, am I going on too long, Whitley? Because
No, not at all. I was just going to reflect that as soon as you mentioned former Indian campgrounds, my cabin was on an Indian campground, and not far from it were the burial mounds of two medicine people.
Ooh.
And, you know, these people, the Native Americans, often with their rituals and their deep understanding of what we earlier in the show referred to as the mystical, they do achieve a state of where they are at the bridge between the physical and non-physical worlds. And that lasts, that frequency lingers in the land forever. And that's probably what the poltergeists were about.
Yeah, it may have been, but, you know, and we were never afraid of it. We you know, always, it's always the footsteps, you know, the toilet acting up, you know, and I changed everything in the toilets. I had plumbers over there, so I knew it wasn't that. It just was that, and particularly it was the footsteps. Always when we went to bed, I used to close the bedroom door. As soon as that bedroom door is closed and we were in bed, you know, tap, 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 tap. And it would go on for a while. And then we had the incident with the cigarette smoke. My wife.
Yeah, fascinating, because I've gone deeply into why that is. Go ahead.
Well, we lived in a neighborhood. It was, you know, we had a half acre lot, and the lots around us were all wooden. They were far enough apart, and nobody in our neighborhood smoked cigarettes, and we didn't smoke cigarettes. But my wife used to travel a lot, and she used to come home, particularly when she came home, she would wake up in the middle of the night and she would say, do you smell the cigarette smoke? And I would wake up really groggy and go, no. And I had my nose broken a dozen times when I was, you know, growing up from all kinds of incidents. And so I said, I don't smell anything. And then, you know, she would go away, come back again, same thing, cigarette smoke. And then somebody sitting on my bed. And then after like the third or fourth time this went on, she woke me up again, and I sure as hell felt it. I felt that somebody was on her bed. And I also smelled the cigarette smoke for the first time. And that was sort of strange. So my wife decided that if we have a poltergeist or a spirit in the house, she was going to contact it with a friend of hers. You know, they were very, very spiritually oriented, and they were going to, you know, basically say, you're welcome to be here. You know, it's
but
okay.
Don't smoke.
Yeah, don't smoke. And yeah.
smoke.
She was. Go ahead. No, I'll just put it in an anecdote to this. She was traveling again, and I was in the yard, and I was doing some gardening in the front yard, and this fellow comes walking up the driveway, and he said, "Do you live here?" And I said, "Yes, I do." And he said, "Oh, my wife grew up in this house." And I said, "Really?" She said, "Yeah, yeah." And I said, "Oh, is your wife here?" And she said, "Well, she's walking around the back of your house." And then sure enough, she came up, and we were chatting, and I said, "Well, you want to see the inside of the house?" Because we had done some work. And she said, "Yeah." So I took him around, showed him the house. And we were in the master bedroom. And she said to me, "This is where my sister and I slept." And I said, "Oh." And I said to her, I said, "Did you ever smell cigarette smoke at night?" And she, the look on her face, and then, and I explained to her, I said, "You know, my wife gets up," I said, "particularly when she comes home, you know, after a 3 or 4 day trip." And I said, "Somebody's sitting on the bed, somebody's stroking her hair, and there's heavy cigarette smoke." Well, she starts crying even more, and the husband grabs her, and I was, "Uh-oh, what did I start?" Turns out her mother was a heavy smoker, and her mother used to come into that room every night and used to say goodnight to the girls and would always rub her hand over their hair, you know, and kiss them goodnight and sometimes tell them a story. She said, "But there's always cigarette smoke in the house." And I said, "Well," and I said, "If this is your mother," I said, "she's welcome, you know, she's just welcome, you know, and what have you." And that sort of, you know, they went away, and we invited them back anytime. They never did. But then, you know, sometimes she would come back from a trip. I'd pick her up at Dulles Airport, come home. And one night at 2 o'clock in the morning, there are her slippers on these little a little stairway went from, you know, the living room, sort of a round stairway that went up to the bedrooms, dangling on the steps, but moving, like to the point where they were moving back and forth, up and down. It's like somebody had placed them there at exactly the right point so they wouldn't fall. They almost fall, but they wouldn't fall. And we both jumped back a little bit, and she said, "Did you do that?" And I said, "Yeah, 1 o'clock in the morning." I said, "Trust me, I'm not playing jokes on anybody. I'm tired, right?" You know. So anyway, little things like that would happen all the time around our house. So, but anyway, you were going to talk about cigarette smoke.
Yeah, because I've done quite a study of this phenomenon because it's quite prevalent, and I've learned a lot about it. First, the Native American community and the indigenous peoples of the Americas use tobacco specifically, not other drugs, but tobacco, to communicate with the world of the dead and with the spirit world. Now, in South America, they also use ayahuasca and so forth, but it's a different type of communication. This tobacco that they use is not what you buy in a store. This is really intense, very nicotine-rich tobacco, a whole different ball game from what you're used to in the stores. Now, when we were living in our cabin, it began to fill up with cigarette smoke, and we found places in the woods near the house where someone was standing and smoking hundreds and hundreds of cigarettes. And this was a hybrid. He followed us to Texas when we lost the cabin.
And I remember that story, yeah.
Yeah, and he smoked constantly, all the time. I don't think he even slept. He smoked all the time. The reason they smoke is that they are hearing the voices of everyone around them in their heads. They are fluently telepathic, unvoiced, and highly autistic, and the males, most of them have Klinefelter syndrome. I think it's called Klinefelter syndrome, yes, which is a chromosomal mismatch that causes them to reach puberty but never go through it, and they simply age as in a state of just at the edge of puberty. They just continue to grow older. And they look like, as I said, when I first saw him, they look like weathered children. They're very odd looking. So they smoke for two reasons. One is the same reason schizophrenics smoke. Schizophrenics are hearing voices in their heads that are self-generated. And the nicotine causes that not to go away, but it smooths out the affect. It makes it more easy to endure. And these people, these hybrids, are constantly hearing the voices of others. I've had that happen to me a couple of times, and it's pretty awful. You definitely don't want to be telepathic if you can't control it, and I certainly cannot. And I don't think they can either. Okay, that's one reason they smoke. The other reason that they smoke has to do with communication. They can't communicate with each other telepathically unless they have nicotine in their systems, and I think probably in the air around them. I got into this with the Grays. I tried to get the Grays once, one of them, to come and stay with me for more than... I started out asking for 2 weeks, knowing I would be lucky to get 30 seconds. I got about 15 seconds, during which time she showed me a tiny cigarette. And this cigarette was remarkable. It was just about this big. And I wasn't going to talk about this on the air, but I've changed my mind, obviously. And it was... written on it in what looked like pen were the most intricate hieroglyphics you could ever see. And I found out that they smoke constantly here because in their world where they're from physically, there is something in the atmosphere that's works like nicotine. And maybe it is something in nicotine. I don't know what it is, but it facilitates telepathy, and they use this for telepathy as we use it and used it for communication between the living and the dead. So it's a remarkable drug, whatever it is. And the hybrids that I know in upstate New York are much nicer than the ones out here in California, by the way. I'm not saying anything bad about them. They're sweet, but they're very good to me in many ways, and I respect them, and I'm very grateful there in my life. But they want me to smoke because they say that, you know, you can be in our telepathic community if you smoke. And I don't want to smoke. I said, well, why don't you vape? I don't want to vape either. I'm not going to do it. And I don't necessarily want to be in a telepathic community because I've been in telepathy a few times. And Dickens and Diane Hennessy Diane Powell, I believe she calls herself now, have nailed the fact that people who are unvoiced and autistic often have telepathy as well. And these are people who are very sweet and very kind. And I wouldn't mind in being in a telepathic community with them. But a telepathic community with the Grays and the hybrids is another story, and I'm not sure that if I couldn't get out of it, I wouldn't have a lot of trouble enduring it. I love them very much. They're very much a part of my life. The Grays are not dangerous so much as they are really different, and they want things from us that we don't fully understand, and it's scary.
Yeah.
But we'll get used to them eventually. Okay. So all of that said, that's why I wanted to bring up cigarette smoke, because it's something that's important in this whole thing. And people need to know, when you smell that in your house and there's no one smoking, it's because this is happening to you. Now, I want to get back also to another thing, which is the juncture in your experience between the time you're in the bedroom and the time you're in the yard.
Mm-hmm.
During that juncture, what happens is this. The hippocampus, which is it's part of the executive function of the brain, which collects memories. They can turn it off. The memories are still in your head and in Debbie's head, but they're not accessible because the hippocampus was turned off. when the movement, you were taken out and probably into a ship and so forth, and that's where the marks came from and where she was intruded into. All of that happened, but you don't have any direct memory of it. If you had a hypnotist who actually knew how this works, and the doctor we mentioned earlier may know some who do, he could probably retrieve those, help you retrieve those memories. They are stored in the amygdala. They are not gone. But the amygdala doesn't have anything. It can't do anything with them because when they came in, they didn't come in with the proper markers from the hippocampus that would tell it where to put them. So they're just sitting in there all by themselves. I thought you'd like to know that.
Well, thank you. I was approached a few times by people who said, you know, have you tried hypnosis? But I remember, you know, talking with Jock, and Jock sort of poo-pooed the idea, and he said, you could, he said, but, you know, you'd have to ask yourself, you know, what are you going to gain out of that? And he said, also, he said, you know, it could make things worse for you in the sense that if you're worried about it or scared about it, it can make you even more worried or more scared, or, you know, just the opposite too. It could be illuminating. So it's sort of like you sort of take your chances. I've always made qualms about the fact that I'm not quite tethered to the ground. I mean, you know, I'm a normal guy, but my wife tells me I'm normal always. But I don't, you know, I scare easy. And I was like, you know, I don't want to go there. And it's like, you know, that's one of my feelings about disclosure, you know, is a sense that I know how I would react to it. And I've been studying this for 40 years. When I was briefed on topics, not so much UAP, but phenomenology, you know, in a classified setting, about what the government had done and has been doing and what the results were, the veil got lifted and I was really upset, and I was upset for a while, and it took me a while to get used to it. It's sort of like you. I mean, you know, the experiences you have been going through now, not just your initial experience, but once you have been through it too, there's a familiarity to it that you become accustomed to. But at the same time, there's a wariness. It never quite leaves. This is where we're like, a guy like Chris Bledsoe, he doesn't seem to have, he sees it in a much more spiritual context than I do, in a very positive spiritual context, which I think is wonderful for him. I'm not quite there. Not quite there yet. Neither am I.
But he has faith, and he has joy. And yeah. Anne used to say, Whitley, if you want to do this, you have to have joy. You have to bring your joy to the experience, and the experience will respect it. And she's right. She's absolutely right about that.
Chris does that instinctively
because of who he is and what he is. Right. I worry about him saying things like this thing's going to happen next Easter. And we've talked about that. I think that one of the trickiest things about the phenomenon is that it has a tendency to predict things that don't actually happen. This is why I never repeat. I've gotten zillions of predictions. And I would say maybe one out of 50 have happened. And that's pure chance. In fact, the visitor's predictions are less good than chance, in my experience. So I hope he survives that in the public eye. And I know a lot of the nuts and boltsers are going to pounce on him when that happens. And I just want to say he's a man trying hard and has a good heart, and he knows something about how to transform this experience into something we can live with.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. I think everybody gets into trouble when they start getting into the prediction racket, and I don't like that at all. If you study, you know, millennialism or apocalypticism, you know that historically speaking, it never ends well for the people who make predictions. It just doesn't. And, right. Yeah, it's, you know, so I, you know, but they have a right to do it. They want to do it. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, let's hope he weathers the storm. And,
yes.
Now I think that we're coming, I promised you an hour and I don't want to take up more of your time. And I think we've come to the end of that time. And at this point, folks, we're going to, in a minute, we'll be with Leslie Kane talking about this in a very different way, because Leslie spent the last year basically going back and forth to Washington. She attended all of the hearings, and she is very clued in on the political side of this, and that's where we're going to go next. Now, but before we leave, I would like to thank Jim Semivan for being a longtime subscriber to Unknown Country, and Leslie is too, and I want to say to you folks, why don't you give yourself a Christmas present worth having and subscribe, or if you're already a subscriber, tell your friends about it, because we have had a steady decline in the number of subscribers as people move out into the social media world more and more. But Unknown Country offers something different. It offers real depth. You can explore in unknowncountry.com for literally years and find time and time again something new, something worthwhile, and something that is going to make you a better person on many different levels. So have a lovely Christmas and a happy new year, and I'm going to wish you the same thing after Leslie. Thank you for being with us, folks. And Jim, thank you for a wonderful show.
It was always an honor. Thank you so much for inviting me, Whitley.
We're not doing any ads in this show, but in the brief break between Jim Semivan and upcoming Leslie Kane, which you're going to love, I'm sure, too. It's a wonderful show. I just finished recording it a moment ago, and this is one of the best Christmas specials I think I've ever done. Jim and Leslie have just outdone themselves. Anyway, one thing that's going to happen early in 2026 is Transformation 2026 is going to be published in audio, in Kindle, and in hardcover and softcover. The book is important. It's very important. The old Transformation, published in 1988, was stomped to death by the media. Hardly anyone read it. This new version is updating it to modern times, and it is the story of how one little family lived with the visitors and had them in our lives, which we did for years, 3 or 4 years. They were coming to the cabin on a regular basis. This is real, and it can happen to you and your family. And these books are a guide to what it's like. It's really strange. It's really challenging. It's really wonderful. And on the other side of relationships like this, there lies a new world, an extraordinary world, a much bigger world than the one that we know now. So get Transformation 2026 as soon as it's out. I think it will be out in mid-January. I'm hoping for January the 15th, but we're still in production, so I'm not certain. Now, the subscriber section of unknowncountry.com has been steadily dwindling because everyone is moving to social media and away from websites. That's understandable, but I'm pretty sure my show is shadow banned on YouTube. Something is done to diminish the number of people who even see it and know it exists, even when they search on my name. Some people get it, but many don't, and it's kind of random. And we do have excellent SEO, search engine optimization. So I urge you to do this. Take a moment. Put it on pause right now. Go to unknowncountry.com. Click on the subscribe tab and subscribe to the site, or just do the donation. There's a donation button right there, too. Give us something to keep going, because I have to pay for this, and it costs me more than I get in, and I'm running out of time. I'm not sure that I will even last through 2026 if you do not do this. It's that serious, and I'm not kidding. I'm not begging. I'm just telling you the truth. All right. Now let's get back to the fun. Get set for one of the most fabulous interviews you've ever heard with anybody. And I would think one of the best interviews Leslie and I have ever, ever done. It is going to range from the issues of disclosure and in all kinds of fascinating directions. Like Jim, Leslie is one of the great pioneers in this extraordinary field of ours, and you're going to meet her up close and personal in this interview, not like you have ever done before. Leslie usually gives very formal interviews, but we've been friends for many years, and it is not one of those sort of formal interviews. Now we have Leslie Cain with us. She's an investigative journalist, a very prominent voice in the discussion of UAP. She has an extraordinary background in research into mediumship, and we're going to get into that as well. But first, we're going to be talking about UAP. She's a veteran investigative journalist. She has written for the New York Times, the Boston Globe, the Nation, the Globe and Mail, the International Herald Tribune I don't believe it's even published anymore, but in any case, she has written for many prestigious papers. She has been on broadcasts on MSNBC, CNN, NBC, CBS, NPR, you name it. And Leslie has been there. And she was profiled in The New Yorker. She is a major voice in shifting public opinion and government attention toward serious UAP investigation. In fact, I know Leslie well, and I think that it's safe to say, even though she probably would object to this, that she is one of the key figures in the burgeoning movement toward more official action in this area. Leslie, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you, Whitley. That was quite an introduction there. I won't bother to object. You know me well. I guess I would say So many of the people involved are, I would accept that I'm one of the key civilians, because so many of the people involved with the efforts you're describing, you know, making things happen behind the scenes and all of that, are former government people. So, you know, there's huge numbers of them, but yeah. And also, of course, that New York Times story in 2017, which I did with Ralph Blumenthal, another key player here, and Helene Cooper was a game changer. So yeah, as a civilian, I've played a certain role here in getting the word out. And prior to that, of course, I had 17 years of reporting on the topic when it was totally taboo before the New York Times story came out in 2017. So there's a long history of work I've done.
And yet you did get stories out anyway, and you kept trying. And, you know, we're going to talk about the age of disclosure and the pre-screening, early screening that you went to and the work you did, the writing you did in the New York Times about it in a moment. But what drove you during the long period when this was a snicker-snicker thing, and the last thing any reporter who hoped to have a career would want to tackle? But you did.
I know. I was driven. That's the word, Whitley. Because once you get that this is real, what else is there to be concerned about? I mean, that's how I felt. It was like, you know, I mean, I'm sure a lot of your listeners know that it was because of this French Cometa report that I got in the mail. And I won't go into all the detail about it. Yeah, that was just so impressive to me. That got me looking into this. And then I published a story in the Boston Globe in 2000 based on that. But boy, was it a struggle to get that story done. And once I was just hooked, because I saw, Whitley, that there was clearly something going on here. And part of what attracted me to it was not just my curiosity and recognition of the significance of the phenomenon itself, but also I was, you know, like, what is going on with people? What is this taboo all about? Why is it there? Why is nobody paying attention? That to me was, you know, I was just this reporter. I was mystified by the attitudes and the fact that an event would happen and our government wouldn't even comment or would make up stories. Or so I also wanted to understand that element of it, as well as being really inspired about just with curiosity about what the phenomenon was. And I just wanted to try to bring credibility to it because it was so irrational to me that people laughed about it. It made no sense to me, what given what I had studied. And when you start looking at government documents and, you know, talking to high-level people, it's just so clear that there's something here. And why is this? Why are there these attitudes? So that's what got me going on it.
You know, I think that they feel threatened. I think especially people with a high level of intellectual involvement in the society, like scientists and academics and so forth, they feel threatened because the suggestion is very clear that someone with more agency in general and more knowledge than they have and probably more capabilities than they can even imagine is here and not talking to them. And that makes them feel very uneasy. It is a form of ontological shock, the shock of overturn, of having your world overturned. And it's not full-scale ontological shock, which is what happens when your world actually is overturned. It's something else. It's a kind of fear that my world might be overturned here if I'm not careful. And the commitments I have made, and my achievements, might prove to be meaningless. That's
absolutely
the core
true
of it.
Yeah, I agree with you completely, Whitley. And you're right, there's two types of ontological shock. There's the one which you and others have suffered who actually encounter the phenomenon directly.
Right.
And then there's
yeah.
more like the intellectual ontological shock, because this is what you're talking about with respect to the
right.
scientific community, the political world. Of course, a lot of that has changed now, but yeah, the threat to their worldview and their whole careers as scientists. They just don't want to go
yeah.
there. Yeah. So, yeah,
well, exactly.
But that's not the same as when it's thrown in your face and you're forced to confront it. That's the real ontological shock.
And I wouldn't want to go there either. Absolutely not. I agree with them. I understand very well. You know, a scientist was at my cabin once, John Glidman. He was a psychologist he didn't have a physics degree, but he was also a very accomplished physicist and a believer in the vision of science to his core. And he was also very interested in what was happening to me. And he was at the cabin. We were all sitting in the circle of stones I had made at the place where I had fairly sure I had been abducted from. And suddenly, this beautiful shaft of golden light came down from above, and it was day, broad daylight, and
wow.
And it was clearly totally anomalous. Everyone was looking at it and peeking at each other through it, because when you looked through it at someone else, their face was just super clear, you know, like it was more real than real. And we were having so much fun, only John couldn't see it. Only John couldn't see it of the 8 or 10 people in the group, including kids. So we went back to the house, and John got a horrible headache. That was his mind fighting to not confront this. That's how deep this goes. And he struggled with that headache for 4 or 5 hours. And I looked back on the previous summer, the summer before my own experience, and I used to get these terrible headaches every day. And I've thought since, maybe I was pushing it away all summer. And maybe when they finally abducted me, they did it because they were just so exasperated that I wouldn't notice them.
That's fascinating. Well, I guess they never abducted John, your scientist friend.
I don't know. If they did, he certainly didn't know it. But here's the point. This whole community is facing that level of denial inside themselves. It's not someone telling them not to talk about it, but right. not you. And not people like Jeff Kripal. You're different somehow. Did you ever have anything prior to this? Any kind of close encounter or anything that would have activated you?
The only thing, one of the most important things I had prior to receiving that Cometa report in 1999, Whitley, was reading Communion. And I'm not just saying that because you wrote it. It's true. I mean, I've read a few books on UFOs, and I remember back in the late 80s reading Communion, and I was alone in a country house in Massachusetts, and I was up literally till 5 in the morning. I couldn't put that book down, and I was alone in this house, and it was sort of scary. You know, and I had read a couple of other books, but that was it. I've never had any kind of close encounter experience or anything like that. And I think that's good if I'm going to play the role I play as a reporter, because I remember all throughout the years before 2017 when I would do interviews, they would always ask me, have you seen a UFO yourself? And I was actually glad I was able to be truthful by saying no, because that preserved a sense of me as an objective, outside, credible person looking in. If I had said yes, then they could have used that against me. Whoops, we got fireworks.
What happened?
Is that because, I don't know. I think it's maybe because I touched my chest, or somebody else is giving us some fireworks.
Folks, we've had some interesting. We've both had our glasses disappear on us. We're both wearing... I'm wearing my backup glasses because someone like me who has apports and stuff disappearing all the time would never go with just one pair of glasses. Leslie lost her glasses, disappeared too, the same day.
Right before doing the interview with you, Whitley. So I'm wearing a pair. Let's just see. Just want to see if it's this. Who did that? So I thought maybe it was the hand gesture, because sometimes that sets off things. But no, I was just saying that I told the media it was good that I couldn't, that I was able to say I hadn't seen a UFO, because it preserved a sense of credibility for me. If I had said I had seen a UFO, they all would have said, oh, she's just tainted by her own personal experience. That's why she's
craziness.
Yeah, but
let's set off the fireworks. The lady back there also spent her life with just a couple of UFO sightings, one of them very ambiguous and one of them so hilarious that it almost didn't count. I know some of you don't know about this. I'll tell you very briefly as an aside. I don't like to talk too much when I've got such an extraordinary person to talk to. But Ann saw, I was begging the visitors to show her a UFO, and we were in our hot tub one night, and this strange noise came, and we looked up, and what looked like a pile of wood covered with Christmas lights moved slowly across the sky. And she said to me, you don't go up in things like that, do you? I said, Annie, I have no idea what's going on, but I've asked them to show you a UFO, and this is what they came up with. And the other one was just an orange light that we saw at Gulf Breeze. So that was it for her. But she was able to have that little distance that was so critical to everything because of this. And I think you're in the same position.
Yeah, now, as a reporter, very important to have that distance, or at least, even if I had more personal involvement than that, I would certainly not make that public. You know what I mean? It's like, as a reporter, there's an objectivity that you have to constantly maintain, and it's good. You want your reporters to be objective, of course. So it's a good thing the phenomenon itself was not bombarding me during those years, or I think I wouldn't have been able to carry.
No, but it just bombarded you a few minutes ago, apparently.
No, it's different now. I just keep thinking it was my hands, but no. How did those fireworks come on the screen like that?
I think that you hit a nerve. You made a very important point, and it's very, very much relevant to Anne, who is quite a part of this.
Maybe Anne's the one setting the fireworks, Whitley.
Quite possibly. But I hate to think that she's the one fooling around with the glasses, but she probably is.
She wouldn't do that. She might do that to you, but I don't think she'd do that to me.
Well, I think the joke is that it happened to both of us at the same time. So, okay, let's go on. Let's go now to the age of disclosure.
Okay.
And the beautiful piece you wrote in the New York Times about it, which I am sure helped the movie, helped it along enormously. Can you tell us, you went to a private screening for the press? And
No, not for the press. Yeah, go ahead. Sorry.
Oh, well, what was it?
Well, it was a private screening that Dan Farrow, who is the producer and director of the film, organized specifically for members of Congress. It was not made public. It was no press was invited except for me and Ralph. We had an exclusive for the New York Times on covering that meeting. And so we were personally invited, but no other media were. And it was a screening. There were five members of Congress in there and some staff and a couple of people from the movie. Jay Stratton was there, a couple of others. And it was basically it was on Capitol Hill in a Senate building on a few days before the movie came out. And it was to show the members of Congress the movie, some of them who were interviewed in it and some of them who weren't. So, it was excellent story for us to bring to the Times because they always want something exclusive. They want something that involves the government. They didn't want a movie review. So this was a very special thing that we could offer the New York Times, and that's why we were able to get the story published. And it was really, really, I actually was in the room, and it was very interesting to be there and to talk to the members and hear what they said about the movie and watch them. You know, they were all glued to it, as you can imagine. It was an interesting experience. I mean, this is the print edition of the story. It came out on it was on the front page. I mean, most people read it online, but, you know, what was really important about it was that it emphasized the bipartisan nature and it emphasized the interest that Congress has in the topic. And that's why we were able to, that's why it was exciting to cover it.
And a few weeks later, there was a long story about the Betty and Barney Hill case in the Times, not written by you, but it occurred to me that maybe they're softening toward this a little bit.
I wish that were true. Yeah, I mean, it may be true, Whitley, because Ralph and I have not, you know, the stories we've done in recent years have all been from the arts section. So this one was for the film department. The one we did up before was on Lou Elizondo's book. That was for the book section. So we will, you know, if there's a news story that comes along that we can bring to the Times, we will try to do that. And it's true, the editors change. People who run the bureau in Washington, there's a new person now running the bureau in Washington. So maybe you're right. I just don't know. But, you know, these are not hard news stories, which is what we really want, like the 2017 story, like the one we did in 2019 about the pilot sightings with Ryan Graves. Right. Those were news stories in the news section of the paper, and those are the really big ones. And so the paper has not been that open to those stories in recent years, but we hope that's going to change, and maybe it has changed. I don't know. We'll find out the next time we pitch something to them.
It plays, you know, I know the history of the New York Times and UFOs going way back into the 50s, and the mood seems to change from time to time. In the early 50s, the paper was just reporting things on a straightforward basis. Then later, it was in 1977, something changed dramatically. And straightforward reporting ended, and it began debunking. And that went on for quite a while. And then there were very few reports. They disappeared almost for years and years. Then suddenly, 2017, you and Ralph come out, everything changes again. Meanwhile, the Wall Street Journal, the other sort of semi-newspaper of record, the New York Times, having claimed that title, I think, rightfully a long time ago, is now publishing, or not publishing, but working on or trying to work on a hit piece about the whistleblowers, trying the reporter, one of the reporters who is involved, sister, works for Grumman, one of the defense contractors.
Really?
So
wild.
You have to think there's something going on there that's not too healthy.
Wow.
But in any case, what do you think that the age of disclosure is having an immense impact. And I also know that James Frey is coming out soon with a major blockbuster documentary as well. So James Fox,
James Fox. Fox. Yeah, I wanted to let the reader, tell people that. I mean, you might know this already. December 22nd is the date of the kind of second version of Moment of Contact, the movie that he already released, but he's redone the whole thing and added some very explosive interviews to that. So that's December 22nd.
That's right.
And so that's going to be a big event too. And it's sort of going to ride on the coattails of Age of Disclosure because he's got firsthand witnesses talking about encounters with this alien, whereas in Age of Disclosure, fantastic movie, by the way, but you know, the critics say, well, there's no evidence, or they're not firsthand, or the Brazilians are able to reveal more. Let's put it that way.
Yeah, they are firsthand. I mean, he had his hands on this being.
Right.
You know, in my book, The Fourth Mind, I consider the event that James's documentary is about, the Virginia UFO incident, one of the most important, if not the single most important event that ever happened, because of the message that was there, that they felt sorry for us because we had lost powers that they still possessed. Lost, not didn't have, didn't possess.
That's
and a whole new world beckons.
Right, that's so fascinating. Absolutely fascinating,
yeah.
Isn't it?
Absolutely,
really.
And I think that James's documentary is going to be of epic importance.
I agree with
because
you.
Absolutely. Okay, let's move on now. We're already nearly half an hour into our hour together in this Christmas season, and so much is happening. Probably the show will be old hat in 10 minutes after we've made it, but maybe it'll still be current. You touched on the Comita report as being an important part of your realization that there was really something here. I know that you knew Bud Hopkins and were aware of his work before that, but it didn't kind of gel for you until you saw the Comita report. And it just appeared. Did someone just send it to you? How did you get it?
Yeah, a colleague from France who had a magazine in France called VSD. It was sort of like Time magazine here. Lots of pictures and kind of news magazine. Sent this report to me. It had been translated by Lawrence Rockefeller. And it had come out already in France, but it hadn't gone anywhere out of the country. And he sent it to me and said, you're the only American that has this translation. We're going to send it around, but you can have the exclusive. Would you like to do something with it? And I read it, and I was blown away by it, Whitley, because the thing is, reading your book, reading Bud's work, yes, those profoundly affected me, but there was nothing I felt I could do with those as a journalist professionally. It never would have occurred to me I ever could have covered this topic as a journalist. And when I got this Cometa report, that's when I realized you've got generals and admirals and government officials and scientists and people like that studying official documents, studying official cases for 3 years, coming out with a report and saying the most valid and rational explanation for these is the extraterrestrial hypothesis. And that's something that a reporter can deal with because of who the people are. There was a whole group of them, right? And 4-star generals saying this, it was like it made me realize – this is a story, you know. It's not it's just different when you have government people at that level involved, as you all know. And that's sort of the why I've had to stay with on along that path, because that's who people listen to. So, yeah, I mean, that's how it all started. And it was just amazing to me that there was something that just arrived into my life. I mean, literally, that report completely changed my life. I never would have covered this thing otherwise. So I forget what your question was.
You've answered it beautifully. I knew Lawrence and loved him dearly. He was a wonderful man who was fighting not only public resistance, but also within his family. His family did not
look kindly
on Lawrence. Yeah, I'm sure you know that. But he had an enormous role to play in this world, and even though he's passed on, the role survives. The Comita Report and other things that he did were very, very seminal, and they've turned out to be exactly what he'd hoped, but he did not live to see that, and unfortunately.
It's unfortunate, but yeah, if you want to think of it that way, the fact that he translated that and that it was given to me was really what precipitated everything that happened afterwards that I was able to do, because I would never
Which
become involved
otherwise. Communion is the first step. It announced the presence of the visitors in many lives and activated tens of thousands of people to understand that this had actually happened to them. But then you come along and you take it all to another level, a different level. Where we are now. So the two of us are really, really compadres in that sense.
That's true. And I just hope there's a way. What one of my major goals is, Whitley, and it's has to be done very gradually, but is to find a way to bring the experiencer element into the mainstream narrative. Because as you're pointing out, it's always been sort of this separate thing. And all that people care about are national security and what the members of Congress are doing, you know? And we need to find a way to integrate them. And I think James Fox's movie is a step in that direction. And I'm hoping that, you know, that's one of my goals anyways, to find a way to do that more and more. And I made statements about it at the Soul Foundation conference, which people applauded. So I think we're going to move more in that direction where these two parallel lines are going to intersect at some point. And I want that to happen soon, you know, because people like you who have been sitting there with this for decades with nobody taking them seriously, it's got to find a way to be integrated. And here you, with James's case in Virginia, you have people who have actually witnessed the live alien. So therefore that helps, bring credibility to the people who have actually encountered these beings and no one's believed them. And we have to mention you mentioned communion and how the thousands of people that recognize their own experience. I mean, just so in case people don't know that those letters that were sent to you that Anne collected are now at the Archives of the Impossible at Rice University. And people can go
read
the thousands of letters that were sent to Whitley from people who had experiences, which his book precipitated. His book made it possible for them to feel talked to anyone before, gave them permission, right?
It gave them permission and access to their own voice. And she's like Lawrence.
She
was a seminal figure in this who didn't get to live to see the fruits of her labors. Being Anne, she's still here, and I'm sure she's well aware of this. But still, it would be nice if she had survived, and especially for me, because I'm terribly lonely every second of my life.
Oh, really?
Not
it's
so much
hard.
For Annie, because she's so much around, but for the touch of her and the feeling of her presence. And you know that too, because you've got
it's understandable. I mean, we all lose loved ones, but you and Anne were so deeply, deeply bonded, and that's why you're able to still, you know, be in contact now. I mean,
I just want
to encourage anybody who's interested in this to go read those letters at Rice University at the archives.
Yeah. And
I think they're all going to be digitized, I think.
Yeah, it's easy to do. You just have to go and get, you know, it's not, you don't have to be anyone special. You can go in and read the letters. Yeah, you just have to. You can't take them out, and you can't take the addresses off or anything like that. You can't.
But they're life changing. Life changing to sit there with boxes and boxes of these letters, handwritten with drawings, and just go through them. It's really, really an amazing experience. Anyway, so yeah, we have to find a way to integrate all of these, and I think the work at the John Mack Institute is going to contribute to that also. This. Bringing the experiencer element into a more credible framework that we can integrate in is really important.
And there are John Mack letters there also, and Karen Austin of the John Mack Institute and John's dear friend is there. Jeff Kripal is there as well. And so it's a wonderful situation. And I think we all owe an enormous debt of gratitude to Jeff Kripal, who made it happen. Jeff made it happen.
Jacques Vallée also, who made it happen by donating his archives to initially. He was the first.
And Jacques started it all by saying, yes, to Jeff, I will donate you my archives. And those archives, some of them are going to not be released until after I have gone over to the other side. But hopefully by that time, I will not need the kind of curiosity I feel right now. But I'm sure that some of Jacques are sealed still, is what I'm saying.
They are. That's correct. Yeah. 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 I think for at least, I don't know, 5-10 years or something like that.
Now let's talk a little bit about where this is all going, because we're at the beginning of a new year. Mm-hmm. Age of Disclosure is coming out. James's epical documentary is coming out and will literally be out by the time this is aired. Huh. So and there are other things happening in Washington. And here's my question. Is there ever going to be anything at any level that really identifies this as an official a level of official concern? Would the president ever say anything about it, for example? Could that happen?
I'm not a seer into the future, but I know that there are some key members of Congress who are passionate about this topic and are really working hard on it. And some of them have tried to get, I mean, I think Tim Burchett recently said he was going to have a meeting with President Trump. Some people have speculated that Trump might say something. I mean, we just don't know, Whitley. But I think these members, you know, the ones who do the hearings, the ones who are interviewed in Age of Disclosure, are going to try to make that happen. And
yes.
I think I just can't. Trump is just so unpredictable, and you know, I'm going to keep my politics out of this.
Precisely because Trump is so unpredictable, I think there's
that
a possibility he might do this.
If he feels that some way it will benefit him, then maybe he'll do it. I don't know, but again, it's just speculation. But I think that what the members of Congress want, Whitley, is for Trump to sign executive orders that will release the some of that classified knowledge that the firsthand witnesses have. The people who are in Age of Disclosure, right, are only allowed to say so much. So the effort now is to try to get an executive order which frees them from their non-disclosure agreements and allows them to present more information to the public, more specifics, as long as it's not violating national security problem. You know, as long as not nobody wants to threaten national security. But clearly there is a lot more information that the public could know and should know that does not threaten national security. And I think part of what these members of Congress are working on with to try to get Trump to sign some executive orders to free these people up so they can come forward and say a lot more to the public than they've been able to say before. And that I think that maybe is feasible that could happen and that there's going to be a lot of pressure placed on Congress for that to happen. So that's conceivable to me that that could happen.
The pushback from the Defense Department, which will be continuous, even in the presence of such an executive order because of the situation they and the defense industry are in. They're going to immediately try to broaden the definition of what is a national security issue, because to them, all of this is a national security issue, especially when it comes to revelation of things like the Air Force can't do anything about them, or revelations of the fact that there are so many patents that lead back to the materials, and those patents are questionable by their very, because of their origin. This is all stuff that is highly sensitive to the Defense Department, but isn't actually a national security issue. The patent issue is a legal issue, and so forth. So they're going to be pushing back, and they're already pushing back. But they have a friendly newspaper in the Wall Street Journal trying to discredit these people, the whistleblowers, so that anyone in the White House will look at that and say, "Well, these people aren't reliable. We can't rely on them. So we're not going to do this." It gives them an excuse, a way out.
That's true.
And yet, at the same time, there's another thing happening, and that is that the phenomenon is getting closer and closer to the ordinary people. And what do you think of the possibility that the phenomenon, and by that I mean any part of it, the grays, the whatever we choose, begins to interact with ordinary people in provable ways? What would happen then?
I don't know, because it's sort of been happening already, right? I don't know about but
it's not provable is a video taken preferably on a street corner in a public space where a non-human entity and a human being are interacting.
Right.
That's what I mean.
Of course, everybody can say it's fake or it's AI, and that's the problem. I mean, even if our government releases something, people can discount it.
But not necessarily. When I say on a street corner, I would assume that it would mean that numerous people were witness to it.
Yeah.
In other words, it was a public, not something that happened at night in somebody's bedroom.
Right.
Because there's zillions of videos of that sort of kind, and they're going to be more now that AI has taken off like a rocket. And God, I mean, Avi Loeb was just about destroyed by AI, fake AI videos of him on YouTube.
I know.
I asked, for example, my brother he's not directly in this space, but he follows it because of me, and his own personal interest is there. And I mentioned Avi Loeb to him, and he said, "Oh, well, that guy, he's the one who's claiming it's an alien, 3i Atlas is an alien spacecraft." I said, "No, he's not." He said, "Well, I saw it on YouTube." I said, "Those are all fake. They're fake."
Horrifying.
Now, YouTube refused to take them down at first, saying, "Oh, well, they don't violate our community standards." But he lawyered up on them, and they took them down. And I thought to myself, what are their community standards? More clicks? Then that's all the community standards they have? So.
Right.
All of this is under the surface and kind of boiling up from below.
And it's only going to get worse.
Right. I see a place for journalism in this.
Mm-hmm.
I really do. I see a place for journalism, good journalism, in the question of the use of AI and things that are happening to people like Avi Loeb. And I also see journalism in finding out where the pushback from the Defense Department in Congress is, because it's there.
Right. Yeah. No, it's a tough thing to find out. But speaking of the AI issue and what the year coming, Whitley, I just want to mention Diana Pasulka's got a book coming out called The Others. And I've been privileged to read her manuscript. I haven't finished it yet, but it's really a profound book. And I think it's going to be another major event of 2026 is when that book comes out. The other big event is the Spielberg movie that's coming out in June, which is getting already so much hype, and the trailer just came out, and, you know, everybody's talking about it. But I'm very excited about Diana's book. And it does deal with some of the questions about AI and how that integrates with our culture and all of that. So I don't know. I don't know how to answer that. I think the advantage of having government videos, government information come out is that, you know, they can't claim it's AI. I mean,
yeah.
If the government sanctions it, and I'll never forget the line that Lou Elizondo made, the statement he made in the Age of Disclosure movie, when he said, if you had seen the videos that I saw when I was with ATIP, you, like me, would know 100% without a shadow of a doubt that we are not dealing with human technology here. I mean, it's all there in videos. Why can't the people see the ones that can be scrubbed enough, you know, so that we don't reveal our own sensor devices or whatever it is they don't want us to know about? Those videos are there. But I think the fact that they're government videos, Whitley, really makes a difference in terms of people not being able to claim whatever they might claim about them being fake or generated by AI or whatever. Just makes it cleaner, you know?
Well, doing that, because there are videos of beings that
Absolutely.
Are in the possession of the government.
And, I'm sure it's true.
Living beings and also of dead bodies. And there were, I've been known this for 25 years, at Fort Detrick in Maryland, there were bodies. I don't know if they're still there, but they were there for a long time, certainly. I was told about them back in the 1990s. And there's no earthly reason the public shouldn't know this, but there is a problem. The problem is that it starts a snowball rolling for the Defense Department. And
right.
that snowball gets bigger and bigger and bigger until they completely lose control of everything. And what they are hiding, I don't think it's legal to hide it. I don't think it is national security. It's the things I mentioned earlier. And, you know, we're basically dealing with something that slipped out of the protection and restraint of the law a long time ago.
That's right.
Where do we go with that when they're essentially engaged in a criminal activity? The whole thing is a criminal activity.
That's what the whistleblowers are trying to, that's what makes them whistleblowers, is that they're calling out illegal behavior on the part of these programs. And the fact that they're hiding this from Congress. And, yeah, I mean, how do we do it? More and more people have to come forward, and more information has to be provided that allows law enforcement to track it down. I don't know how that happens. I do know that members of Congress, I actually, Whitley, at the it was very interesting to me at the – when I was covering that congressional screening of Age of Disclosure that we talked about earlier for the New York Times – I had a conversation with Representative Eric Burleson just before we screened the movie, who's a major player in trying to work for the UAP issue in Congress. And he's the one who David Grush now works for as a staffer. And he was telling me that his position is that, and I think this is true for a lot of the way the thinking is for a lot of them in terms of looking forward, that it's not so much about continuously having hearings over and over again. He kind of feels like what's more important is what you're talking about, is that we get what he calls the receipts, meaning physical evidence or documentation of at some level that is concrete. He says we've got to get those receipts. And so then, you know, that's what I'm working on. He said that's more important than another hearing or more people come out and talk about this. We've got to get the receipts. And then I said, well, how are you able to do that? Do you have the information to do that? And he says, well, yes, I know enough people behind the scenes. I've been told enough information to follow it up. But then he said, but I can't get access. And that really, made an impression on me. I can't get access. Just like everyone else.
Yeah.
Get to a certain point, you beat your head against the door, and he's a member of Congress. And you can't, you know, there's a certain level where that's it. So, I mean, it's like you're saying, it's like it has to be done, but how it gets done, it's going to have to go at such high levels of law enforcement, I don't know, you know, that somehow if they've got to break through this wall that is very powerful and is keeping people from doing proper investigations where they can actually get these receipts that they're talking about wanting to get.
And is NHI, non-human intelligence, involved in some way in supporting the Defense Department's secrecy? I wonder.
I certainly can't answer that one, Whitley.
No, I'm just saying, I wonder. Because
do you think that, yeah?
Well, I think there's conflict at that level.
Mm-hmm.
And I refer back to the Crabwood crop formation of 2002. And it was not made by lasers by the military, by the way. I know that Jacques Vallée believes that implicitly, and I don't think it's entirely correct. It has that comment in it, beware the bearers of false gifts and their broken promises. There is good out there, much pain, but still time. I have a feeling that the false gifts or the materials and all the bodies we've gotten, and I know a whole lot about that whole world of exploration dating back into the 80s when I first learned about the work that was being done at the Battelle Memorial Institute, which claims it never did this and that's false, mm-hmm. on the Roswell materials. That's there. And NHI is deeply involved in this. Is their whole wheelhouse. So they must be controlling it at some level.
You would think, because if they wanted disclosure, they could show, they could make it happen in a day. Just do whatever they need to do to show up.
So therefore, they don't want it.
Yeah, I guess that's a rational, that's a reasonable thing to conclude. Or you could say they want it, but they want it very, very, very gradually.
Well, yes. And what worries me is something I've thought. Do they want this? Do they want us to end up in a situation, which we will probably be in X number of years, where we know for certain the planet can't support us anymore? Then we're helpless, and they show up. Because, you know, I love Chris Bledsoe, and I talked in the earlier segment about him with Jim Semivan, because Jim knows him well and loves him, too. And Chris represents to me a way in for the general public to be able to deal with this. I'm not so sure that me and the other abductees are such a good way in, because our stories are just hair-raising, as you found out when you read Communion all those years ago.
Right,
but
exactly.
His aren't. Mm-hmm. And maybe a situation could develop where more and more people find out they can attract orbs. Maybe that's how it starts.
As long as it seems like more and more people are seeing orbs, wouldn't you say? I mean,
yeah.
Physical orbs, not just something they take of the camera that you can't see with your eyes. I'm talking about things they can actually see, right?
Yes, they are.
I don't know.
And they're able to call them up. John Martin, the YouTuber, he calls them up all the time and sits on his back porch and Tennessee or somewhere, and plays guitar. He's a wonderful classical guitarist, and says, oh, how beautiful, thank you, thank you. And these wonderful orbs come across the sky and do all kinds of things. They're not satellites. They're,
right.
They're absolutely not. Most of them, some of them are, but of course, but not all.
Yeah.
And if he can do it, it's, to me, it says, what I'm saying here is, this may not be only about government disclosure. This may be about public engagement.
I think you're right, Whitley, and I think you're right. And for, you know, The reason I stay with the beat of the government is because that's what, you know, my job is to get stories in the New York Times, and that's what that's all they're going to publish. But I agree with you.
Well, you know, you stay with the beat of the government because this is absolutely critical. And you're right. I don't think the Times is going to publish a story about John Martin and the orbs.
No, but to me, that's fascinating. And I spend a lot of time talking to people and looking into it at that level, too. And I think what the point you're making is for it to attract people, it's got to have this sort of positive element to it, like Bledsoe has, rather than the scary element of the abduction phenomenon. You know, it needs to have.
Right.
And I think there are lots of contact stories and encounters that are positive for people. And they may not be with the gray aliens, but they may be other types of experiences like you're describing with orbs. I mean, Lou Elizondo wrote about in his book Imminent. Even he wrote about these orbs that would come into his home and float around.
Right.
You know, it's like, and those, you know, if as long as you're careful, I know that for some people, and this was written about in the Skinwalker books, it can cause harm to your body if you get too close to them, depending on the nature of the orb, of course. I'm sure that doesn't happen always, but if one does show up in your house or something, you don't want to get too close to it just in case. But nonetheless, you know, that's not like a gray alien taking you against your will. So it's a very kind of different kind of encounter that I agree with you is something that people can accept a little more easily, that it's some kind of a surveillance mechanism, perhaps, or something. You just have to be careful with orbs if they are going through your body or getting. I think Lou even said there was one color that was safe and there was one color that wasn't safe. And I don't remember what the colors were, but it's in his book. So,
we had a disastrous experience with a sort of iodine purple, pinkish orb in our house. That was a dreadful experience. I've talked about it enough, actually, and I'm not going to talk about it now.
Yeah. Lou talked about blue and green ones, as I recall. And imminent.
Yeah, this was
blue and green. One of them were safer than others.
Well, in any case, it's possible, at least from a distance, like Chris sees them from a distance, and they sometimes come close to him. But mm-hmm. I don't think that these are dangerous orbs. I'd like to move on to the other level of your exploration of the world, which is surviving death. A journalist investigates evidence for an afterlife. Now, as you know, Anne concluded that there was a connection between NHI and our own dead and became a master of the afterlife, the only person ever to create an avatar that actually was provable. I mean, I've got a picture of that avatar sitting on the head of someone at a conference at Esalen, the white moth that she...
And I've seen that myself, Whitley. I remember one time we were on the phone and we were talking about Anne, and your surveillance camera at that moment picked up the white moth flying through the room, and you sent me that video. And it was right at the moment when we were talking about Anne. I've seen it. I know what that looks like. Yeah.
Because she became an enlightened being, a little gal from Ann Arbor, Michigan, which tells me, you know, that the enlightenment is not about someone that's not us. It's about you and me, folks, all of us. And that's where we need to go in order if we're going to keep this species growing and expanding and becoming more beautiful than ever every day. But surviving death, you were drawn to an interest in the afterlife for some reason. It doesn't necessarily, I mean, most people who get in interested in the UFO phenomenon do not also become interested in the afterlife. So what gives?
I guess that's a good point. What gives? I think it was all, to me, it was all connected to a sense of an expanded awareness and expanded consciousness about the nature of the world we live in, the unseen world. And UFOs were sort of part of that world, even though I was focusing very much on sort of the hard data, nuts, what they call the nuts and bolts aspect of UFOs. Nonetheless, I was very aware that there were other aspects to it. And during the whole, I'm talking about pre-2017, the years I was exploring it. And so, you know, I had, those were the two big questions for me. Are we alone in the universe? And what happens after we die? Do we survive death? So it seemed natural to me to be interested in both. I don't know. My interest in that began when I studied the work of Ian Stevenson, the psychiatrist from the University of Virginia, who studied cases of small children who remembered past lives that could then be verified. And we're talking about 2 and 3 year old kids who, you know, talk about specifics from a past life. And as a reporter, Whitley, when I saw that, it was so black and white to me. It was nothing like nebulous, like a lot of the sort of, oh, the near-death experiences are beautiful, but, you know, this was like hardcore data to me that had no other explanation for it, where you have a 3-year-old and you have a list of 10, let's say, or 12 absolutely specific memories with names and places and all kinds of specifics, and you can take that information and go back and find who that person was in that past life, what they call the previous personality, and see that that child was accurate in every point that he remembered, or she. And like how, and he hadn't, he or she, the child had not been exposed to any of this information as a kid. The parents didn't know anything about the past life. So it just gives me chills to even talk about it, because I cannot think of any other way to explain how that could happen other than consciousness being fundamental, consciousness being something that is functioning beyond the brain, obviously. I mean, if you want to argue it wasn't a past life, maybe it's some other mechanism of memory or something, or connection to that previous life, that doesn't mean the child actually lived that life. Nonetheless, it's showing us something about the nature of consciousness. And it's so black and white that, here I am as a reporter looking for hard data. That really did it for me. And so that opened up the whole world to me of exploring the nature of the afterlife. That's kind of how I initially got into it. And in my book, Surviving Death, which you just mentioned, I open up the book with the cases of these young boys, 2 American boys who remembered absolutely, one of them remembered like 50 different things that were verified of a past life that they had. That sort of was my entry point into it. But what's interesting to me, Whitley, is that when I wrote Surviving Death and I'd done all this research into it, as including my own experience with mediumship and after-death communications, which I integrated into the book, I still didn't see any connection between that and UFOs. And I thought this book was something completely separate. And it was only afterwards that I started to see the connections, thanks to people like you and Anne and others who have really asked that question and brought forward really interesting information that links them. But it took me, so that's, to me, is a really fascinating question about how they're all interconnected. And I'm not an expert on it at all. But I did want to, in that book, what I wanted to do was present the most scientifically oriented data to show that the afterlife, that certainly you can, there's enough data to suggest that it really exists, that we do not disappear when we drop our bodies at the end of our lives. And that was my goal in the book, to be very journalistic and scientific about it. But I did bring in my own personal stories into it, which felt risky to me to do as a reporter, but I did it, and it's been okay. I have not suffered as a result. So anyway, but I think you are one of the pioneers, Whitley, in cooperation with Anne, of trying to integrate and show how those two worlds intersect. The world of the UAP and the UAP encounters and the world of the afterlife. So I'm not going to try to explain it, because you can do a much better job than I can. But I'm fascinated by that question.
I think that I can sort of sum things up here when we're talking about you, Leslie. I think you are a person who is data first, beliefs after. You're going to follow the data. and you're going to go where it takes you, and you don't care about any preconceptions or beliefs. You really are not a person with a lot of preconceptions. I know you very well at this point in our lives, and you don't actually have those. You're fascinating in that respect. You're always there. The first way you approach anything is a question. You start asking questions, and that's because you don't have any assumptions about it. That's why you've gone down this road, this extraordinary life road, and it is one of the great life roads of all time, in my opinion. You changed the world. You and Ralph did in 2017, and there's no looking back. And where will you take us next, Leslie Kane? 2026 is coming, folks. It's right around the corner, and some of you are listening to this in 2026 or watching it. What a world. And now I would like to ask whatever invisible presence amused itself by taking our glasses to give us our glasses back.
Please, we need them. But I love it when these things happen, as long as, you know, it's not that disruptive and they do get returned. It's happened to me before.
Well, I mean, it's not that disruptive, or we wouldn't be wearing glasses. Because I mean,
that's true, but it's true. At least we have a second pair of glasses, but I have the ones that I didn't lost were specifically ones I wear during podcasts because it allows me to see you better. But nonetheless, I can function with these. I'll let you know, and we're gonna let each other know, Whitley, about these glasses.
Absolutely, folks. And if the glasses return, we will let you know as well. Leslie Kane, thank you so much for being with us, and welcome to 2026, everybody. May it be an interesting year. And this, in this case, it's not a curse.
Well, thank you, Whitley, and thank you for doing the great work that you do. And the podcasts you do, there is nothing else like them out there. And I'm so grateful to your books and your work, too. And I'm grateful to know you. So onward to 2026.
Onward. I'd like to make a brief comment at the end of this show, primarily about the weird things that happened during the Leslie part. First, the animated fireworks. My Zoom client is not turned on to do that. We don't think hers could do it when she made the gesture she did, but it happened because she did make a gesture that would cause that to happen. So somehow or another it happened. Paranormal or para-Zoom, we don't know. Second thing, the glasses. Leslie found her glasses. They were in the trunk of her car. Now, that's an odd place for glasses to end up, indeed, but there's an explanation. She said on the show that she'd looked everywhere, but of course she didn't think to look in the trunk of her car. Who would? She opened it, though, and there they were, because it turned out that they had been in a bag that she had taken in from the car and fallen out into the trunk. So that's the explanation for Leslie's glasses. My glasses are well and truly gone. This is the second weird thing that's happened with glasses in my life. I have lots of apports that take place in here all the time, so it's nothing new. And I only would like to end this with a plea. If someone in the invisible world stole my glasses, please give them back. I can't afford to replace them, and I always keep two pairs handy. I think that's wise. So I'm asking for my glasses back. That said, Happy New Year, Happy Christmas, and may 2026 bring riches and joy in this tired old world of ours. Let's go into each one of us, into our heart, and say, this year my resolution is to make things new again and make things better for all I can reach. I love you. Thank you for being my fans on Dreamland. More to come. More to come.